It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. In the chapter in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind called Mind Weeds, Roshi makes a comparison between the waves of thought in our minds and weeds in a garden. And he says that we pull the weeds and bury them near the plant to give it nourishment. And likewise, we should be grateful for the own our own kind of weeds, because eventually they will enrich our practice. Knowing this with our heads, however, is not enough. We have to actually experience how the waves of thought that go through our mind during Zazen actually change into nourishment. Strictly speaking, Roshi says, any effort we make is not good for our practice because it creates waves. It's impossible, however, to attain absolute calmness of mind without effort. So we make an effort, but then we forget ourselves in the effort. Then our mind is just calm without even awareness. This is such a subtle point, as all his points are. But put another way, we can encourage ourselves and make an effort up to the last moment when effort disappears. And we should try to continue this kind of effort endlessly. But we should not expect to reach some stage where we'll forget about it. At first, the effort is quite rough and impure, but by the power of practice, the effort becomes purer and purer. When effort becomes pure, body and mind become pure. And so this is the way we practice. Once we understand our innate power to purify ourselves and our surroundings, we can act properly and will learn from those around us. And this is the merit of Zen practice. When you're practicing, you begin to realize that your mind is like a screen. If the screen is colorful enough to attract people, then it will not serve its purpose. So we have to have a screen that's not colorful, to have a plain, pure white screen. And it's the important point, because most people are not interested in a pure, plain white screen. Most people want a colorful screen and to attract attention. But this is not our way. Suzuki Roshi explains this by saying that a white screen is not something that you can actually attain. It is something you always have. The reason you don't feel you have it is your mind is too busy. Once in a while, you should stop your activities and make your screen white, and that's Zazen. This is the foundation of our everyday life and our meditation practice. And Roshi says that without this foundation, our practice won't work. All the instructions that we receive are about how to clean the white screen even though it is never pure white because of our various attachments and previous stains. So that's pretty clear. He's boiling everything down to everything we're learning is about making our screen pure white. But that's very difficult because we have attachments and previous stains. However, Roshi actually says that if you don't trust your own pure white screen, your practice won't work. And you understand that white screen means Buddha nature. So we all basically are, we just are Buddha nature. It's not like we have Buddha nature. Because if you think of it as I have Buddha nature, then you separate the two and they're impossible to separate. So we are Buddha nature. And it's something that we always are, but we cover it up and then we forget. And then we behave as if we never heard of it. So to summarize, about right effort, Suzuki Roshi actually makes seemingly two contradictory things. First, he says we need to make some effort, but we forget ourselves in the effort we make. And then he says we should try to continue our effort forever, but we should not expect to reach some stage when we'll forget about having to make it. So he sort of contradicts himself. We make an effort and we make an effort and then we forget about our effort. And then we need to always continue our effort. But we shouldn't expect to reach a stage where we'll forget about having it. So, you know, he often intersperses something baffling, like he'll say, intellectually, my talks make no sense. But if you have experienced true practice, you'll understand what I mean. Things like that. And at these times, what he says is especially contradictory, so that your brain kind of shifts out of place, that's when it's most true. It's a conundrum. It's not what we expect to hear. That it's most true when you're expecting to hear one thing and you hear something else and you just kind of do a double take. That's when you need to pay the most attention. Roshi goes on, if while we continue to make continuous effort, we are always looking forward to the day we don't have to do this anymore. So if we're always looking forward to the day we don't have to do this anymore, then our attention is on the time we don't have to do this anymore. And that dilutes the effort we're making. Also about effort, I think there's some misunderstanding. The effort is not in what you're doing. In whatever it is that you're doing, you offer your wholehearted, full-on presence and engagement. So effort is constant. And effort is inconstancy. We need to always be making an effort. Although Roshi says, at the end, you can just forget your effort and it makes itself. But it's not about what, it's about how. I think I've told you this before, but someone once asked Roshi what the most important thing in Zen practice is. And he said, when your alarm rings, get up. And I've heard him say, when your alarm rings, you should be out of bed before it stops. So not to dawdle. The effort then is in constancy, in the keeping on part. You show up and do your best, and that's it. And all of this becomes easy if you forget about making progress and concentrate instead on showing up. I find that this is a very hard point to teach. I think our culture is so geared toward accomplishment and gain that we have to remind ourselves that actually that's a distraction to practice, which is just keeping on. Once we decide, we have to decide, I want to do this practice. And once we make a decision, as you remember, I'm sure Roshi said, never make the same decision twice. So you make a decision, I'm going to do X, and then you just simply do it. You show up, you do it. And there's not a lot of talk about it. But showing up day in and day out is not easy. And if you pay attention, you'll probably notice that every single day there'll be an obstacle. Being intentional in a rocky sea requires steadfastness. But that is the effort. The effort is the steadfastness. It's not the boat we're building. It's showing up in the garage every morning at 7 to build it. And Roshi says, Buddhism itself is neither good nor bad. What we are doing what we should do, that's Buddhism. You know, when it's time for breakfast, we eat breakfast and so forth. When it's time for sleep, we go to sleep. We just do what we should do, one thing after another. And you might think, what a boring life. But actually, when I was staying at Green Gulch, I had a lot of time to reflect. And I became aware that the thing that makes me happiest, actually, is knowing what the right thing, right next thing to do is, and then doing it. Like, whether it be going to Zazen, or telling someone where the restroom is, or chatting with someone at the dinner table, whatever it is, I feel happy understanding what it is and then doing it. It's very simple. And we know this from the inside. An outsider can't see this side of things. And what it looks like from the outside has almost no bearing from the happiness part either. So when we talk about effort in Zen practice, we're talking about this continuous knowing of the next right thing to do and then doing it, and so on for the rest of our lives. Mostly, we can't know, at least I know this is true for myself, I can't know the next right thing to do practically until I'm almost on top of it. Because things change, everything is in flux, the circumstances surrounding each situation are constantly changing, and it's our job to read these changes and then adjust our behavior to the most current arrangement. Doing this, there's no problem. The problems come when we have a preconceived idea of what we want to do and are foiled. But when we're just flowing along, following our day as it unfolds, there is no problem. Well, you could say, if I had my heart set on accomplishing a certain thing and the day never allowed me to do that or even touch it, I can't help but be frustrated and upset. But this may not make any sense to you, but I found that the right thing leads to the right thing. And I think it's true because of the purity that's built up. Your chance will come to do the thing you had hoped for, because there are devas that protect the ones who have cultivated purity and provide the openings wherein you do get what you want. It may not come in the form you expected, but it may be a better form, one you never would have dreamed of. That's the way these things work. You might say this is magical thinking, but you can't say that till you give it a try. And anyway, magic is real too. I once brought a friend to new to Zen practice to a one-day sitting at No Abode, the monastery of Tenchin Roshi, my teacher. And as we were driving back, he told me how all day long he had been corrected. He had corrected by this person and that person, and he tried not to let it get to him, but it clearly had. And I told him that that was just how it was for me for the whole 11 years I lived at the Zen Center. But the truth was that just about every correction was correct. I mean, I did need to, the truth is, brooms do need to be stored with their brushes upwards so the brushes don't get smushed and bent out of shape. And the dishwasher really does need to be filled from the back to the front. Really, one can thank one's fellow participants for providing this kind of free education on your behalf. But it's hard for a beginner, especially. As I listened, I sympathized, but I also knew how much he was benefiting. And I think he did actually too. Corrections are like compost. You stir in appropriateness to one's lack of training in appropriateness, and you get training or greater purity. Weeds are nourishing when stirred in properly. Therefore, the provider of correction needs to be skilled in both the proper way to make a correction, in the timing of the correction, and the knowing the nature of the person being corrected. And so it's a job for advanced students, not just anybody willy-nilly. So, and I think maybe that's what happens if you live in a community setting and everyone feels free to correct you all the time. Not everyone is qualified. Suzuki Roshi calls this understanding the marrow of Zen. In the Zazen posture, your mind and body have a great power to accept things as they are, whether agreeable or disagreeable. And at that point, he tells that wonderful story from the Buddhist scriptures about the four horses, the four kinds of horses. I know you must remember this. We had this very early on in my lecture series. The best horse will run absolutely according to the driver's will before it sees the shadow of a whip. The second best will do the same just before the whip reaches its skin. The third one will run when it feels the pain on its body. And the fourth one will run after the pain penetrates to the marrow of its bones. And Roshi always, when he tells this story, he always comments, must be really hard for the fourth kind of horse to learn how to run. And he also comments that when we hear this, we probably all want to be the first kind. And we may even think that the purpose of Zen practice is to teach us to be the first kind. But Roshi says this is not the right understanding and that it doesn't matter if you're the best or the worst. You understand why already before I even go on. It doesn't matter because the only thing that matters is keeping on. So once you're practicing, the only thing that matters is to keep practicing. Best or worse is irrelevant. But Roshi says, if you practice with the great mind of Buddha, the worst horse might be the most valuable. He actually says that those who can physically sit perfectly usually take more time to attain the true way-seeking mind. And way-seeking mind, by the way, is an empty mind ready to receive anything. So it's a beginner's mind. You're ready to receive anything. But Suzuki Roshi makes this point again and again that we need a beginner's mind to practice correctly, actually. Otherwise, we'll be full of gaining ideas. I think I'm the fourth kind of horse. It just took so long for the bodhisattva vows to bloom inside me. But because I can tell you about this, it's not a waste. And this is how we support each other. And Zazen helps us see it. Another teacher puts it differently. He says, beauty, wealth, and intelligence are the biggest obstacles in Zen. And you can see why. A very beautiful woman, it would be hard for her to stop and consider, who am I? You know, why am I here? What is this all about? Because she gets a lot of attention. And so does a very smart person, and so does a very rich person get a lot of attention. And so it makes them harder to question what they're doing. Or even, why am I alive? What is being alive about? Is there any meaning to this life at all? And you're more likely to ask it if you aren't beautiful or intelligent or rich, this particular teacher says. I know that our new saint, John Henry Newman, asked these kind of questions before he was even 5 years old. And some of us ask these kind of questions while we were still teenagers. But others, when death is on the horizon, they begin asking these kind of questions. But even the latter, even if you don't start asking these kind of questions till you're about to die, if you're determined, you might still arouse a way-seeking mind. And it's never too late. But then Roshi says, in your very imperfections, you'll find the basis for your firm way-seeking mind. And those who can sit perfectly physically take more time often for the true way to obtaining the true way of Zen, the actual feeling of Zen. He calls it the marrow of Zen. But those who find great difficulty in practicing Zen will find more meaning in it. So I think that's very important for all of us to hear that, because I think a lot of us have difficulty, and it's a difficult practice. But when we struggle and we continue to struggle, but we don't give up, we find great meaning in this practice. And the other thing that I found was understanding practice, just understanding the difference between let's say, writing and the practice of writing. They're entirely different. Because in the practice of writing, the focus is on showing up to your writing practice. And in writing, the focus is on attaining some stature as a writer, or publishing, or being a good writer, or something like that. It's very different. Then Roshi says that in some sense, there's no worst or best horse, because the best is who you are already. When everything falls away, your natural mind naturally is way-seeking. So our natural mind, which is Buddha mind, Buddha nature, our natural mind is already way-seeking. So in a sense, we don't have to worry about it. We just have to worry about staying inside our natural mind and not cluttering it up with a lot of junk. Suzuki Roshi extends what he says even to our sitting posture. The posture taken in Zazen is not the same for each of us. For some, it may be impossible to take a cross-legged position. But even though you cannot take the right posture, when you arouse your real way-seeking mind, you can practice Zen in its true sense. Dogen's words for this are shoshaku jushaku. Shaku means mistake or wrong. Shoshaku jushaku means to succeed wrong with wrong, or one continuous mistake. So a Zen master's life could be said to be so many years of shoshaku jushaku, which means so many years of one single-minded effort, or so many years of doing one right thing and then the next right thing within the context of continuous mistakes. I think that's really how it is, actually. There's the context of one continuous mistake and then the effort to do one right thing after one right thing. Roshi says, if you find it impossible to sit because of some pain or some physical difficulty, then you should sit anyway using a thick cushion or a chair. Even though you are the worst horse, you will get to the marrow of Zen. The reason for this is that in the Zazen posture, which one has acquired by long, hard practice, one's mind and body have great power to accept things as they are, whether they are agreeable or disagreeable. When you feel disagreeable, it is better for you to sit and in this way work on problems and accept them. So he's basically saying, here's what to do when you feel disagreeable. Do Zazen. It'll help you accept it. And it does. It really does. Probably you've all had that experience. Roshi asks, when you are sitting in the middle of your own problem, which is more real to you, your problem or yourself? The awareness that you are here right now is the ultimate fact. This is the point you will realize by Zazen practice. In continuous practice, under a succession of agreeable and disagreeable situations, you will realize the marrow of Zen and acquire its true strength. So here are some of the most important points. If you have some experience of how the weeds in your mind change into mental nourishment, your practice will make remarkable progress, and you will feel the progress. Way-seeking is an empty mind, ready to receive anything. In some sense, there is no worst and best, because the best is who you are already are. When everything falls away, your natural mind naturally is way-seeking. The white screen is not something that you can actually attain. It is something you always have. The reason you don't feel you have it is because your mind is too busy. Once in a while, you should stop all your activities and make your screen white. That is Zazen. I'm not sure I said this next one today. When you do something, you should burn yourself completely like a good bonfire, leaving no trace of yourself. That's related to what we said today. I don't remember saying that today, though. If you leave a trace of your thinking on your activity, you will be attached to the trace. In your recollection, you may say, I did such and such a thing in some certain way, but actually, that is never exactly what happened. When you think in this way, you limit the actual experience of what you have done. And finally, it's not the boat we're building, it's the showing up in the garage every morning at 7 to build it. So what I have for your reflection during this week is a little different from usual. So this idea, if you leave a trace of your thinking on your activity, you'll be attached to the trace, has been poignantly written about in a famous short story by Chekhov called Enemies. And I'm going to tell you the plot of this story, and you'll see exactly what Chekhov is about. But it's exactly Dogen's point of, if you leave a trace of your thinking on your activity, you'll be attached to the trace. And I think this is an extremely interesting point. And I'd like to have this as the center of your reflection this week. So Chekhov's story is this. A doctor and his wife are kneeling by the bed of their only son, who is 6 years old and has just died. The doorbell rings and the doctor answers it. It is someone he has met before who begs him to come to his home this minute because his wife is very sick and may be dying. The doctor is vacant and cannot think clearly, and finally tells the man that he cannot come with him because his son just died and he is useless. He can barely stand up. But the man continues to plead, saying that it's not for him, but for the sake of the dying person. And finally, he promises the doctor that he will have him back in an hour. The doctor relents, but doesn't tell his wife that he's leaving. On the way, he wants to turn back to take care of her in some way, but they're almost there and it's too late. So the next thing we know, the man discovers that his wife has left him. She faked being violently ill so that he'd leave to get a doctor. And while he was away, she ran off with some man her husband doesn't think very highly of. So now he's furious and he can hardly contain himself. So he screams and yells till the doctor interrupts and says, "What is this? Where is the sick person? You brought me here for her, and now you're shouting absurdities," and so forth. And they go back and forth, accusing each other of wronging them in a loud, violent language. Eventually, the doctor gets driven home, and Chekhov concludes the story by saying that over time, both the men calmed down and were more open to understanding each other, but that during the night of the main event, both of them formed strong opinions of the other person, and those opinions will last forever. They will not change. And this is exactly what Dogen is saying. If you leave a trace of your thinking on your activities, you will be attached to the trace. So these two men were violently arguing. And then when they calmed down, they realized, oh, well, you know, it's understandable the doctor didn't want to leave and is angry that he left in vain because his son just died. And the doctor can think, it's understandable this guy was so furious, his wife just left him, and so forth. But they don't forget the strong opinion they have formed of each other while they were fighting. It takes Chekhov to make a point like this. So your assignment for the week, if you forgive the language of assignment, please reflect on this truth and relate something from your own life experience that shows either its validity or non-validity. And you could even do both. You could relate an experience that shows how that actually is so and has been so for you, or you had an experience maybe similar to the Chekhov story, but you didn't form an attachment to, you didn't, it left no trace. So that would be interesting too, if something like that happened to you and it left no trace, which would be unusual, but it'd be super interesting if that happened to you. I've purposely made the talk a little shorter today so we could have as much time for questions as possible. And again, as I have been doing for this whole series, I encourage you to ask questions about your personal practice. Anything at all that's you're finding an obstacle to your daily zazen routine, I very much want to help you with. So please feel free to ask whatever questions come to mind.
Thank you, Gail. So the first question that we have is, can you please go over again ways that one can decide what is the right thing to do? I understand that it is easier to determine this the closer it is to the event, and also that the benefits of doing the right thing may not be immediately seen. When I try to decide the right thing to do, I can get easily buried in all the various considerations.
That sounds like the problem itself. The right thing to do is instinctual. You just know. It's something you just know. And if your mind is too busy, which it will quickly get if you're debating, well, should I do this or should I do that? And then, well, let's list all the reasons, pro and con for this, and then by the end, you know, your mind is just swimming, and you're way away from just knowing. So it's the just knowing part. And you do just know if you don't clutter your mind. So sometimes when that happens to me, I'll kind of make myself stop and I'll just see if I can't find that flicker of just knowing. You know, I'll have been spinning around and then I just go, you know, stop. And then even in that second right there, there's a sense of just knowing. And to follow that, to follow what you just know, that's how to know the next right thing. And so this is, it returns to Suzuki Roshi's seminal teaching of beginner's mind. When you have beginner's mind, it's an empty mind, and that's a way-seeking mind also. It's an empty mind, ready to do anything without preconceived ideas. And so you just do the next thing, and it's evident what it is if you allow it to be. Try it. Try decluttering. Try just going backwards, and until you get to the empty mind place. I'm not saying it's easy, but you can get there. And once you get there, especially if you get there from this cluttered place, you realize you can get more skillful at sensing it. Like, it's easier for me to be in a cluttered place and stop and then feel what it is that's the next right thing than it used to be. So you can cultivate that awareness. It's almost like cultivating a taste for food or for a certain food or something. You know, you just find that part of you that understands why it's delicious, you know, or what the deliciousness is, or what the quality is that's so special. You just have to cultivate it. And it's not actually that hard. Thank you. That's what I find to say right now. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. The next question we have is, how can we know that our mind naturally is way-seeking? I believe it because it sounds right, but I don't actually experience it.
Well, you're here. You're here, right? You're here. You could be out having pancakes. Maybe you've never thought of it this way, but your desire to learn and grow and understand and become more skillful and compassionate and kind, they're all about a way-seeking mind. That's exactly what it is. And, you know, some people don't do anything but party, let's say. Drink, that's their main thing, drinking and partying. But even that, it's a kind of dysfunctional way-seeking mind. Just like alcohol is a dysfunctional form of trying to heal. So there's a way-seeking, you have to understand, a way-seeking mind is Buddha nature. And that's our original nature. We all are that. It's what we're made of. So there's no separation between you and way-seeking mind. And what appears to be separation is busy thoughts. It's confusing yourself, habits, unconsciousness, all those things get in the way. But that's why, Suzuki Roshi, you're constantly saying, just trust. Just trust that it's already there. You already have, you know, that you're enlightened. This is going to come in a few, one of the next few talks, that we need to attain enlightenment before enlightenment. We attain enlightenment before enlightenment. Because it's already there. These are one of the Zen things about Zen. Not to try to understand with your head too much. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one we have is, this is more of a comment than a question, but the idea of Zazen being a way of returning to a basic white screen is really helpful to me. It explains things better than a word like nothing or emptiness. It's just making the stage empty, and there's something so relaxing and clean about that, and relieving also. No wonder we feel renewed afterwards. Even a short period of sitting feels so refreshing afterwards.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. You've said everything. I don't have anything to add. But that was very helpful. Thank you.
So we have this one. Could you say more about the statement, when you do something, you should burn yourself completely, like a good bonfire, leaving no trace of yourself?
Well, it's the same as I always talk about, that we need to focus on the quality of our effort, that it needs to be wholehearted and completely present and engaged. I think, and I'll add, without a lot of preconceived ideas. And the big mistake, and it's just universal practically, is to focus on the results of your actions instead of on the doing of your actions. If you focus on the practice of whatever it is, there's deep satisfaction in that. Always. And if you focus on the result, there's oftentimes no satisfaction even. You just are full of self-criticism and doubt. The first way, in focusing on the quality of your effort, you also learn when you've made, you just trust what your best, you make your best effort, and then you actually know inside, that was my best effort. I just did my best effort. And then you learn to believe that. And then you recognize what your best effort is. And then you increasingly trust yourself. So that's also a benefit of this. It's like, I know when I've done my best. You know, I'm not lying to myself. I'm not telling myself I've done my best and I really could have done better. I can stop now because I've done my best. And that's a wonderful feeling. It's very satisfying. And people who are result focused, often can't say that to themselves, that they've done their best. In fact, I've heard just the opposite, especially in the writing community. I hear people say, you can never edit enough, you know, and that's absolutely not my experience. I feel, you know, I edit, and then something in my stomach says, you're done. And years later, I'll go back and I was done. There's not a single thing I want to change. Years later, I might not have written that same piece again, but in that piece, there's nothing I'm going to change. And I think it's because of the state of mind of pure concentration when I was writing and editing, and also the trusting. Because the same person who said, you never know when you've edited enough, also feels when they go back that they always find mistakes. And again, that's not my experience. So it's really interesting. I just really believe in the quality of your effort, creating a certain purity that's real. Thank you.
Thank you, Kale. So the next one we have is regarding our Zazen practice. I have read the Roshi emphasized bowing with Zazen. I'm able to keep a daily practice of sitting by myself, but don't really understand bowing. I don't bow at the end, but it becomes more of a deep stretch on my muscles. Can you say anything more about bowing in Zazen?
Yes. Yes, I can. And I think also I might be talking about this again in the few talks that are left, because Suzuki Roshi thinks bowing is really super important, especially for Americans, because we're so full of ourselves, basically. So he asks Americans to bow 9 times after they finish Zazen, full bows all the way to the floor. Whereas at a Heiji in Japan, they only bow 3 times, because bowing teaches selflessness or egolessness. We need to bow to forget ourselves. And it's not like we're bowing to anything. We're just, or if you need to think you're bowing to something, you can think you're bowing to your Buddha nature, let's say. I mean, you don't have, it doesn't, the bowing isn't about who you're bowing to. It's just about the act of bowing. The act of bowing, the posture, is a humble posture. And we need to experience full on with our whole body that humility to kind of get the importance of egolessness, which is critical for spiritual development. So if you're doing Zazen and you're not bowing, I would recommend I'd recommend one full, complete bow all the way to the ground, and maybe 2 more standing bows, just, you know, like that. Just so you experience with your body one full prostration. And don't worry too much about the form. There is a form to it. And I think there's many places on your body that need to touch the ground. But just if you get down there and you actually, and your forehead touches the ground and your hands touch the ground, and we usually raise our hands once, that's sufficient. I say once, at least for starters. So one full bow, one full all the way to the ground bow, and two standing bows. That's what I would recommend for starters, so that your body experiences the humility that we learn from bowing. It's a practice of selflessness, and we all need it again and again. We all need it. We can't get enough of it. So to just start with one, knowing that Suzuki Roshi recommends nine, and then two standing ones, so you have three bows basically, would be a good way to get this practice off the ground. I think you'll find that you feel a greater sense of completion with your zazen, even if you've only done 5 minutes of zazen. So you do your 5 minutes, and then you do one full bow, and then two standing bows, and that's all. So it would be like another 3 minutes, maybe two minutes. It won't add a lot of time, but it'll be a very, very good experience. And it's better for you to understand with your own body what bowing is than like believing my words. But just also, you can trust Suzuki Roshi as a teacher. And bowing was like a big, big, big deal in his teaching. He talked about it a lot and felt very strong about it. I don't think we have time for more questions. But if you think of any, write them down and you'll have, I think, 3 more weeks, I'm pretty sure, to ask. And I really want to focus on the questions, these next few talks, so that you get everything answered, at least for now. So thank you so much for being here. And I want to thank the people who are present during the week also, and my team, Brendan and Sahar and Brian, for all the work they do behind the scenes. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.